to cover tonight. We're going to go from 1900 to the present day, and I can only hit the highlights. But I do want to get all of it. I'll try to get it in the hour, but if we run over a little, I'm going to run over. I'm going to finish. But I'll move as fast as I possibly can and hope it'll be worth your while. We're going to briefly look at the church from the time of the division between the brethren who stood for the truth and then what ultimately became the Christian church. The division, of course, was officially recognized even by the government in 1906. Now, that's where we stopped off. In 1906, there were 2,649 congregations. They were located in 33 states and territories, and there was 159,658 members of the church standing for the truth, and there were 2,100 gospel preachers. So you can see after the other digression, we didn't wind up with very many standing for the truth. And the same, of course, was true with the digression that we've just been through. Now, these local churches were mostly rural. And in 1936, Churches of Christ were the most rural churches in this nation. And many preachers in the beginning of this century, they were preaching without any stipulated amount for their preaching. And many even believed that it was wrong to take a stipulated amount. And this thing was debated around on up till about 1930. We generally think of the preachers in the North and the summer movement. Of course, they opposed the stipulated amount. But this was also a problem in the South. And many congregations, they wouldn't have a regular preacher. They'd have a man maybe come in once a month. Or they might have two men a month. Brother M.C. Kerfees, he worked here in Louisville. It was the old Campbell Street Church, and then we knew it as the Holloman Avenue congregation. He worked there as a local preacher for 45 years, from 1886 to 1931. And Brother Kerfees, he played a great role in educating the brethren on what the truth was about having a man to labor with them locally like I labor with you and supporting him. He played a great role in the educating of brethren through the Gospel Advocate. He wrote several articles, and brethren began to recognize that it was scriptural for a man to locate and to give him a stipulated wage. But preachers, at the turn of the century, what they would do, as you can see, there wasn't many congregations, and young men starting out, why, many times all they'd do is go into a community, and they'd find a schoolhouse that somebody would let them have, or maybe they'd build a bush arbor. In other words, they'd cut a lot of bushes down, build them a frame, and put it on it, and walk around through the community and tell the folks that we'll be having a meeting over here tonight. And people would show up, and they would begin to preach, and they would go home with the neighbors. You might just choose a different man every night to go home with and spend the night. Of course, people were more friendly in that day and time, and they'd invite the preacher home, and he'd preach several weeks and get a congregation started. And after they'd get one established, then they'd get up enough money to build a cheap meeting house. And in 1936, the value of the average meeting house of Churches of Christ was $3,000. Now, that was a lot of money. A lot of them wasn't worth $3,000. And I have a few pictures here. I thought I'd just... So many of you worshipped in these meeting houses. That's one in Monroe County they used, I believe, on up till about 67, it was out of law. Here is one in Lauderdale County. That's the old congregation I attended. It was built in 86, tore down in 48. Here's some over in Virginia, some that I picked up. Just to give you some idea, if you will, here, you can pass some of those back through there. Maybe for young people, maybe they've seen some of them, maybe they haven't. But that's on the average what brethren had. And many of us have worshiped and spent many an hour in those old meeting houses. And so brethren were very, very poor. I mean, after the digression, the money and the houses and all of that went with the digressive. We started with just about nothing. We started really on better ground after this digression than brethren did in the early 1900s. Now, Brother G.C. Brewer, when he graduated from the Nashville Bible School in 1911, he went to Chattanooga, Tennessee, to live and labor in the gospel, and he was promised his room and board by an old brother by the name of Beall. And that he wasn't promised any money. And so Brewer went over there, and he preached for the Central Church and spent a lot of time in holding meetings in all parts of the city of Chattanooga. And he established several congregations. Finally, he built up the Central Church, where he was preaching to about 125 members, and they, on their own, they decided, well, we'll give him $75 a month, and that was a pretty good salary. And, of course, he had him a sweetheart. He wanted to get married. Of course, when they raised him up to $75 a month, why, he got married. And then old brother John T. Lewis, he finished the Nashville Bible School May the 24th, 1906, and in November of 1907, he moved to Birmingham, Alabama, to work with a congregation that had been established, and it was meeting in the third loft of a grocery store, and it was known as the Fox Hall Church of Christ. It was later known as the West End Church, and far as I know, I guess it still exists under that name in Birmingham. But in a short time after Lewis got there, the brethren, they began to complain, and they said, we can't support you. Birmingham is it's just a hard field to make any progress. Well, there'd been a fellow there before him that you may be familiar with the name, if you're familiar with the old-timers, who played an important role, was an able preacher by the name of C.M. Pullius. He was there as a young man and had worked in 1879. He had moved over there, carried $100 with him. He had a young wife, and he stayed a year and spent his $100 and had to leave. But there was a brother by the name of Barnes who had money, who did a lot of preaching. And he is able to support himself. That's what the brethren liked. They like to get their preaching for nothing. Now, what we need to do, we need to appreciate some of these men in these early days that was willing to make all of these sacrifices. Go into a community and work simply for their room and board. Well, coming back to old Brother Lewis, after the brethren told him they didn't think that they could support him, there was a blacksmith that was a member of the church by the name of McDaniel. And he told Brother Lewis, he said he had his house paid for, and he made enough money at his trade to feed him and his wife, and there'd be enough for Lewis to eat at his table. And he told Lewis to come and eat at his table, and his wife would wash Lewis's clothes. And Lewis stayed on in Birmingham with this fella, of course, feeding him and taking care of him from that standpoint. Brother Lewis, he held meetings under tents in 1908. He used a tent for 6 months. He had borrowed this tent from another congregation, and he used the Bush Arbor, and he used every place that he could get an audience. Brother Lewis, he was instrumental, either directly or indirectly, in helping establish 40 congregations in Birmingham. And when the digression came, Birmingham stood better than any city in the nation because of the influence and the work of John T. Lewis. I have a tape a fellow gave me the other day down in Alabama of John T. Lewis preaching. And I'll try to hunt it out if some of you would like to hear Lewis. He was an able old man, and he was an able young man, a man of great, great influence. But see, the brethren, they'd have let him left. If it hadn't been for that blacksmith said, "I'll feed you." You see sometimes how little faith we do have. And we find, as we go and look at Brother Lewis, he was 90 years old when he died. He didn't die until 1966. And Irvin Lee, you're familiar with Irvin Lee. He's still around. He's 70 years old. He lives down in Athens, Alabama now. I've known Irvin Lee since I was a boy. But when he started out, he is a Kentuckian. Irvin Lee started out preaching over in Callaway County, Kentucky, and he started out in the 30s, and his father fed him, and he'd go out and clean off a place in the woods and hold meetings and use schoolhouses and things of this nature. I'm just giving you some understanding of what men went through, the sacrifice they made to bring about the growth to get us on the road again. We were down and out. Brethren had a very misconception about their duty and responsibility in supporting men, but there were men who were determined to preach the gospel and build the cause, and they did. Now, Churches of Christ in the 30s, they were made up, of course, of poor people. Really, many of these people were almost on the edge of just dire poverty. And the meeting houses, they were poorly insulated and poorly heated. Many of you have been there many a day. The old pot-bellied stove, you know, and it'd freeze you to death, and the wind coming through the cracks on a cold day. And the buildings, they had no classrooms. But they had classes. What they'd do, you know, you'd get a little wad over in this corner, and a little wad in that corner, and a little wad in that corner, and a little wad in this corner, and you'd get a wad or two through the middle. H. Leo Bowles said in 1934 that he attended a congregation and they were having 10 or 11 classes in an auditorium. You think about that. What confusion, you see. And at this period of time, it took a while, you know, for brethren to begin to build on to their buildings, even though they were having classes and believed in classes, to begin to get these buildings in shape where they could have classes and do a good job at their teaching. The contribution, of course, would simply be a little change. A lot of folks just dropped in a penny or two on Sunday morning. Most of these classes, of course, they were brief and very poorly taught. Now, there were some good teachers. Don't misunderstand me. There were some good, informed Bible students at this period of time, but also there was a lot of poor teaching that went on. Most churches, they just simply met for 1 hour each week on Sunday morning. Now, this just went on for years among the churches. They'd have what they call the preaching Sunday once a month. And whenever the preaching Sunday came, why, most of them wouldn't have any Bible classes. We'd just meet that hour and have the preaching, you see. The preacher then would get the contribution. And, you know, when I started preaching, there were still some churches still operating that way. And you get through at the end, you know, and they'd come around, whoever's taking care of the money, and say, hold out your pocket. And they'd pour it in. And you'd get home, count your change and things, see what you got. We've come a long way, brethren. We've come a long way, even in my lifetime, as a gospel preacher. In many sections of the country. Attendance and contribution, it would vary according to the weather and the popularity of the preacher. No doubt that's where many times brethren got the idea the preacher was preaching for money. Because when they were dumping it all in his pocket, why, they thought if he's preaching, you'd want him to put in a little more. Now, gospel meetings were always held in the summertime. Of course, you can well see why their buildings were not equipped. Most of them, you know, had the lamps, the old lamps around the wall. They'd have them up with the old reflectors. And I look back sometimes at gospel preachers preaching in meetings. And think about how hot it was, how poorly lit the buildings were. And now those fellows, they went through a whole lot to preach the gospel of Christ. It'd be hot, and you stop and think about trying to think. Of course, a lot of times their lessons had to be with a lot of simplicity. You couldn't, you know, to go into a whole lot. They had to get their lessons down well, memorize them, get them simple. And maybe there's a great lesson to learn from that. Well, they converted a lot of folks. They got the lesson over and folks understood it. After World War I in the 30s, the one-man missionary society came into existence. And there wasn't much interest at this period of time in preaching the gospel overseas. You can see a lot of brethren wasn't too interested in supporting it even here in America. Even though the gospel was being preached and churches were growing, but they didn't have a lot of interest in the 30s. And so you can see how one-man missionary society could get going. One man would be interested in support of preachers overseas, and so he had begun to go around among the brethren and say, now, you send your money to me, and I'll send the money to the men that are in the fields, you see. And one of the main one-man missionary societies operated out of Louisville, and he was a premillennialist, Don Carlos James. He lived in Louisville, and he operated a one-man missionary society for years. He died in 1944, and when he died, he left a will, and when it was probated, there was approximately $40,000 left to E.L. Jorgensen, who lived here in Louisville and was a big premillennialist. And that $40,000 was left to promote premillennialism. And, of course, he'd gathered that up from brethren all over the country. Now, let's look at R.H. Bowell and premillennialism in Churches of Christ. R.H. Bowell became a dominant force in Churches of Christ and in the affairs of Churches of Christ in the first half of this century. He was a giant when it came to intellect. He had a great knowledge of the Bible, and he was a leader of men. He was a man that got along with the poor, and he got along with the rich. He was a man that knew how to cultivate people. He was born in Germany. He had spent 15 years training in Catholic schools, no doubt even for the priesthood. But he'd come to this country and wound up down in Tennessee working on a farm, and he was converted and baptized by a man by the name of Sam Harris. And after Bowles was baptized, he attended the Nashville Bible School that had been started by old brother David Lipscomb. He got out in 1900. And in 1903, he came to Louisville, to Portland Avenue, and held a series of gospel meetings. The following year, the brethren invited Bowles to move to Louisville, and he continued to preach for Portland Avenue for 52 years. He died in 1956. Some of you may remember when he died. He spent 1 year, there's one exception in this, there was 1 year he did leave Portland Avenue and he went down to Lawrenceburg, Tennessee. That was in 1910. He went down to Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, and he spent a year teaching in the public high school. He went down there because there was a rich man down there by the name of J.H. Stribling. J.H. Stribling, S-T-R-I-B-L-I-N-G. He was a man of great wealth. They were friends. He wanted him to come down there, and he went down there, and he spent a year. It didn't do Lawrenceburg any good, because he had already, of course, espoused his premillennial views at this time. And those premillennial views stayed in the Lawrenceburg church, the old downtown church, until the early 1940s. And a Kentuckian by the name of B.G. Hope and a young fellow by the name of Robert Welts was in school at Fried Hardeman. And they hired Robert Welts to come and work with B.G. Hope. Robert was to lead the singing and B.G. doing the preaching. And B.G. moved there to get rid of the softness and premillennialism out of the old downtown Lawrenceburg church. And he did. And the old church is still there. It's sound. I held a meeting there a few years ago, and the last time when I was, my brother-in-law passed away, I saw the preacher that preaches there. He was at the funeral. But B.G. Hope was quite a man in his day. He loved the truth. He stood for the truth. And he fought the battle of premillennialism. As I say, he rooted it out of the old downtown church. But it went back to that period of time when R.H. Bowles had spent a year in Lawrenceburg. Now, F.L. Rao, and I'll give you some understanding of how Bowles became a premillennialist. F.L. Rao, he was the editor of the Christian Leader. And the brethren, they were trying to get up a debate with Charles T. Russell. He was the founder, of course, of the Jehovah's Witness movement and was a premillennialist. And so they wanted to have a debate. And so Rao, he contacted Brother M.C. Kerfees, that was preaching for the old Campbell Street Church, as we said, became Haldeman Avenue, and R.H. Bowles about who would be a good man to debate Russell. Well, they recommended a man from Denton, Texas, by the name of L.S. White. And both Brother Kerfees and Bowles, they worked to get the debate up. So they got the debate, they held the debate in Cincinnati, Ohio, in 1908. Kerfees and Bowles came away from the debate with two different attitudes. Kerfees, he thought White had upheld the truth. Bowles came away from the debate ready to proclaim boldly the doctrine of premillennialism. During the debate, he was converted. He didn't come away to preach the brand of premillennialism that Russell was preaching, but he came away and concocted his own brand to sow it, of course, among the brethren. In 1909, Bowell was invited to become the front page editor of the Gospel Advocate. Now, I have here a 1912 Advocate where Bowell is the front page writer. And some of you might, I run off some copies. You can pass them back through there. Y'all can have these copies if you want them. You may not even be interested in it, but I thought maybe some of you would. But he became the front page writer. Now, that was quite an honor. But by 1910, he wrote him a series of articles on the book of Revelation. And he cautiously presented his views on premillennialism. And on up till 1914, he presented his speculative views in his articles on the front page of the Advocate. Now, you keep in mind, the Advocate was one of the main papers being read by the brethren, you see. Now, in 1915, he decided then that he'd write him another series on the book of Revelation. Now, when he started this series, he was more bold in setting forth his speculations, and this really caused a lot of dissension among the brethren. And so, the editorial staff of the Gospel Advocate, they decided that they could not publish his articles any longer unless he agreed to leave his speculative theories out of them. And they thought they had an agreement with him. And he started back writing, and it wasn't long until he was back doing it again. And so, in December the 30th, 1915, he resigned from the staff of the Gospel Advocate. No doubt, of course, because of the pressure, and the brethren were not going to tolerate it. In 1916, here in Louisville, he started his own paper, and he called it Word and Work. And he was going to teach his views, of course, of premillennialism through this new paper that he started, since, of course, he had lost his audience through the Advocate. H. Leo Bowles, now don't get them mixed up, B-O-L-L is the premillennialist, and Bowles is B-O-L-E-S. H. Leo Bowles, he debated R.H. Bowles, the premillennialist, through the pages of the Gospel Advocate from 1927, May 1927, May the 19th, just to be exact, May the 19th, 1927, to November the 3rd, 1927. They used the pages of the Advocate to debate the premillennial question. Now, you keep in mind, Bowell began to present these views in 1910. They didn't make any effort to get him stopped until 1915. Then after he was cut off from the pages of the Advocate, they never cut off the fellowship with him. He started his own paper, and he promoted his views. Then, of course, they debated it in 27, and at the end of the debate, they did not disfellowship each other. R.H. Bowell visited Nashville and was invited to speak in the chapel service at David Lipscomb College, and H. Leo Bowell sat on the platform with him. In May of 1918, 41 members left the Highland Church of Christ here in Louisville, over in Louisville, And they formed the Bardstown Road Church of Christ. And Bardstown was formed over the premillennial issue. These 41 members came out to stand for the truth. And so Bardstown at one time did have some vinegar and stand for something, you see. It originally started over the premillennial issue in 1918. So you can see that the premillennial issue brought division and discord to churches and divided churches in Louisville and other parts of the country. Several churches in Louisville, they espouse the premillennial view. Many of you are familiar with the premillennial groups that are over in Louisville. And this goes back to all of this period of time that he was promoting this. By 1930, though, a hard-line sentiment was growing against the Bowl movement. From Bowl's teaching on the front page of the Advocate in 1910 and 1915 until the Winchester debate, that's Winchester, Kentucky, which was held in 1933. That's when Foy Wallace met a man by the name of Neal, who was a premillennialist. The tensions had slowly increased in churches of Christ. But I want you to see that this was a overriding issue. As I said in the very beginning, R.H. Bowl played an important role and was a somewhat a central character among churches of Christ for the first half of this century. In fact, the church was almost lost to premillennialism, brethren. The premillennialist, controversy troubled churches of Christ from 1910 until 1940. And no doubt there were still some sympathizers left even at that period of time. The fight to diminish the influence and the inroads of premillennialism in churches of Christ became the priority and the main concern in the 30s among brethren who loved the truth, and especially Foy E. Wallace. The Bowl movement people, they pleaded for tolerance whenever Wallace began to come down on them, and fellows like Roy Cogdill and other men. They wanted tolerance, but they were very militant in advancing their premillennial views. Now, we need to learn something from this. It's like today in this Calvinistic movement. These fellows who have espoused Calvinism, they want to teach it on every turn, but they holler anytime they are exposed. They holler foul. Now, that's the way it always is, brethren. And we have to be wise enough to understand how the devil operates. And Bowl, of course, by crying for sympathy, he had the sympathy of men who headed colleges, who were on college faculties. In fact, the premillennialists, they sent their children to school over to Harding College because the head of that college was sympathetic, you see. They had problems at David Lipscomb College over the premillennial issue. And so we need to recognize this was a great issue. And maybe some of you even had your own families caught up in some of this. Foy E. Wallace, Jr., he met Charles G. Neal in debate on premillennialism in 1933, as I've already stated, in Winchester, Kentucky. Now, this was an effort on the part of Wallace to kill the influence of the Bowl Party, as he called it, and to put premillennialism in disrepute. He went over there to stamp it out and to turn things around. And somebody needed to stamp it out and turn things around, because it's hard for historians to say whether or not the schools and the majority of brethren would have wound up premillennial, but it does look that way, that even after we'd come out of the fight over instrumental music and the societies, the church was almost engulfed, you can see, with premillennialism. And what we need to realize today is this business of Calvinism. We have been fighting that for 15 years. And we got our sympathizers and fellow travelers. And they don't want it exposed. And any hard lines drawn down on anybody. You see, that's the way it is. That's the reason we're studying church history. To learn some lessons. To learn how it is. To learn the way people are and the way error comes in and how it gets the sympathy of even people who don't believe in it and shut the mouths of men who are trying to expose it. Foy Wallace took much abuse. That's evident as you read history. There was probably no man that was hated anymore by those who hated him, and no man probably loved anymore by those who loved the truth and appreciated him for what he stood for. Now, during the fight, there were well-known preachers who would not stand up. In the Abilene Christian Lectureship in 1934, G.C. Brewer spoke in the place of Foy E. Wallace. Foy Wallace could not meet his appointment to speak, so they selected Brewer to speak. Brewer took issue with the harsh attacks that he said that Wallace had made on R.H. Bowles, and he expressed his disagreement with Wallace's efforts. Now, this is just after the debate, you see, over in Winchester, Kentucky. There's always softies around that don't want the hammer to come down. Brewer, of course, I've mentioned him earlier. He started out and made great sacrifice as a young man, getting the work going in Chattanooga, Tennessee. But by this time, Brewer was an able orator and stood high among many of the brethren. But he was a compromiser on premillennialism. Not only that, Brewer was a great leader in introducing the sponsoring church and institutionalism in Churches of Christ. The Bowles movement became then a distinct entity separate from true churches as a whole so far as fellowship was concerned. Now, let's look at the 40s and World War II. Now, the war question and unity were the issues of that day. James D. Murch of the Christian Church and Claude F. Whitty of the Church of Christ, they set out to promote unity conferences in cities across the nation. They were going to bring unity between the Christian Church and Churches of Christ. They had their first unity meeting, February the 23rd, 1937, in Cincinnati. It seems that Cincinnati is a place where a lot of things start. And so, in 1943, old brother Curtis Porter, he wrote concerning the unity meetings. He says, But from all outward appearances that I have seen, it seems that the Christian Church has been the victor in all these efforts, and that unity is no nearer than when the movement first began, except where members of Churches of Christ have moved closer to the position held by the Christian Church. In fact, there's one man in particular I remember reading about who was a younger preacher who went to the Christian Church and espoused these views. All in the world they did, of course, was weaken the efforts. Now this movement was killed by Foy Wallace. He made an attack on this because all in the world it was a compromise. And of course, you see our liberal brethren today, they are still having some of these. They're having a big unity meetings now with the Christian church and trying to merge, and no doubt that'll come off. They don't have, they have too much in common today. But that thing was stopped. But these were the problems during the war. The war question, of course, it took the center stage, because Foy Wallace and Clegg, they championed the cause for those who viewed participation in World War II combat as justified by Bible principles. They took the position it could be justified. Now, that caused them to lose a lot of influence during the war, because a lot of brethren who had stood with them on the premillennial issue couldn't stand with them on the war question. So the Gospel Advocate and the Bible Banner, that was Wallace's paper, they locked horns in bitter conflict over this issue during the war. That's about all brethren could think about during the war, whether or not it was right to bear arms. That was the central issue. But after the war, then as soon after World War II ended, the college question came to the front. The question of church support of colleges, of course, had been around for a long time. Brother G.C. Brewer, bring him up again. There's the liberal question, he was on the side of it. Had argued in a series of 9 articles in the Gospel Advocate in 1933 that churches should support colleges and orphans' homes. You see, and that would be an interesting study. You see, we can only hit the high points of some of these things. In 1938, on the lectureship at Abilene Christian, and this is when Cecil Willis, of course, I'm sorry about his problems of the day and what has happened to him, but he was a good historian. It would pay you to buy his book. It's been reprinted, Odie. On old Brother W.W. Odie. That's a good book. And he did a lot of writing. But Willis said several years ago, Brewer. Brother Willis said he put the starting of the digression in Churches of Christ at 1938. That's when he says our problem started. And no doubt it did. It started right here at Abilene Christian in 38, when G.C. Brewer made this statement. He made some others, but this really caps the stack. He said, "The church that does not have Abilene Christian College in its budget just has the wrong preacher." Well, you can see right then, there were men who wanted the college in the budget. Now, the college issue was somewhat dormant through this period of the premillennial fight. It was there, it would raise its head, but it never did really get going until all of this period of time. Now we were fighting the premillennial issue. The college question did not come to its full-blown controversy until 1946. In 1946, N.B. Hardiman, the president of Freed Hardiman College, he came out strong for church support of schools. Wallace and others, they took up the issue, and the battle was on. And, of course, they were pretty well winning the battle against the college. But in 47, really, N.B. Hardiman changed the battle from the college to the orphan's home. I have an article here in the Advocate in 47, and down in the article, this is what old Brother Hardiman said, "If it is a serious issue to donate to a school, a human institution, why is it not a serious issue to donate to an orphan's home, a human institution?" And that, my friends, is when the battle began to turn. And that's where they wanted it fought. They wanted it fought on an emotional issue because they were losing it on the college issue. Now, when we come to the 50s is a time of division and turmoil in churches of Christ. The promoters of the sponsoring church and human institutions, orphans' homes, and colleges, they were succeeding by the middle of this century. The Gospel Guardian was formed in 1949 to fight the issues of human institutions and the sponsoring church. Yeter Tant was the editor. Foy E. Wallace Jr. started out being the associate editor. Roy E. Cognell was the publisher. They were trying to get a medium to get to the brethren because the advocate, it was institutional. It was going to support it all. The papers that were operating, they, of course, were for the institutions and the sponsoring church arrangement. And so they formed the Guardian that they might have a medium to reach the brethren with. In the first issue, May the 5th, 1949, Yeter Tant said, "As the threatening clouds of an approaching apostasy have grown blacker and blacker, the alarm of Christians has grown apace. Their alarm has been justified. Unless valiant endeavor and resolute action are forthcoming, the church almost certainly faces another tragic descent into the depth of digression and discord." And he was right. Foy E. Wallace said in the same issue, "Certain issues now before the church, Certain issues are now before the church which must be met." That's what he said. "They constitute a threat to the future of New Testament Christianity, just as clear-cut premillennialism did two decades ago, and as digression did two generations ago. These issues shall be met." The time had come that somebody had to stand up. When they started the new paper, there was no editorial welcome whatsoever from the Gospel Advocate. The Advocate, under the editorship of B.C. Goodpastor, was in favor of the sponsoring church and human institutions in the budget of churches. In the autumn and winter months of 1950, the controversy escalated, and more brethren were alienated over the issues. The Gospel Advocate ran numerous articles in the last months of 1950 in favor of the principles of the sponsoring church. Men who wrote for the Gospel Advocate pictured men who wrote for the Gospel Guardian as reactionaries, as radicals, as Guardian factionists. They used the ugliest terms that they could muster. And of course, Annie. You're very familiar with that term. And one of the leading men in the early 50s who used all of the ugly terminology was G.C. Brewer. editor, B.C. Good Pastor, he pursued his strategy to put the Gospel Guardian and its writers in disrepute in the eyes of the brethren. In other words, if you'd have anything to do with Roy Cogdill or Yeater Tan or the Wallaces in the very beginning, they finally cut loose. And many other men like Robert Farish or even Robert Welch, and a lot of these fellows, you know, to even be caught speaking to them almost was bad. They intended to destroy them and to destroy their influence. Good Pastor, in November and December of 54, he took a very significant step to quarantine and isolate brethren who opposed the sponsoring church arrangement and human institutions. In November the 18th, 1954, he printed a letter from a well-known elder. I don't know who he was. He didn't name him. He just said he was well-known. And this well-known elder, he wrote this letter and alleged things about these hair-splitting, hobby-riding, church-busting preachers. Something had to be done about them. In December the 9th issue of the Advocate, he printed some more letters that were commenting on the letter that the elder had written. And in the other letters that he printed, there was the suggestion that a movement come about to quarantine preachers. And I'll read. This fellow said, "I trust you will not consider me presumptuous if I suggest that perhaps the writers of the Gospel Advocate, might wisely spearhead a movement to quarantine those preachers who today are sowing the seeds of discord among the brotherhood and to thus prevent further divisions." Now, after this, the quarantine spirit swept America. Churches began to divide. Preachers began to have their meetings canceled. Weak preachers who couldn't stand the heat, they began to write to the Advocate and make their confession of errors. Fellows like West, as I told you, he has some good books and stood for the truth, but he couldn't stand the heat. He made his confession. Let's see, I think I have his confession here. Yes, he made his confession September the 19th, 1957. John Cox, you just named some of the biggest names, couldn't stand the heat when the pressure of the Advocate. It had, it was the biggest paper among the brethren. It had the power. And it was going to crush anybody and any preacher that got in its way. And so we see that this movement on the part of the Advocate, it had its effect. Other papers then were started to fight the battle. The Preceptor was started down in Florida by James R. Cope and men there connected with him at the college. The Truth Magazine was started in the North in 1956 by Brian Vinson, Jr. Searching the Scriptures was started in Florida in 1960 by H.E. Phillips and James P. Miller. Debates were held throughout the United States. The first debate was held in Indianapolis in 1954. That's when Charles Holt stood for the truth. He met W. L. Toddy and Sterrell Watson in a debate on these issues. Roy Cogdill met Guy N. Woods in 57 in Birmingham. Yeater Tant met E.R. Harper in debate in Texas. Cecil Douthat, who preached two times in Louisville and in his older years in the 60s, moved back and worked with the old Holloman Avenue. Many of you may remember old Brother Douthat. He debated it. He met Tom Warren. Tom's still around, of course. He's a conservative liberal. And he's having to fight for his life. It's sort of funny to read what Tom Warren and those fellows write now as they're in a struggle, a death struggle, to keep her from just going over the edge in ultra-liberalism. But they created the monster, and they're going to have to live with it. A.C. Grider had many debates. He met Woods. He met W.L. Totty. And y'all all familiar with Grider. Grider met Woods in 61 at Gott's Chalk School. They call it something else now. There on Taylor Boulevard. Really, the debate Grider had with Woods turned things around and solidified things in Louisville. I know that personally. I was living and preaching in Louisville at the time. Charles Holt in 59 was still sound, and he met G.K. Wallace in Florence, Alabama. Miller met Woods in in Montgomery, Alabama. And I think he met him, he had a debate in Florida. I believe he met him even in Florida. And there were many other debates, too numerous to mention. This was what was going on during the 50s and 60s. So through the 50s and 60s, you better turn your tape over.